From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, 3 years after Act 10 changed the face of Wisconsin, we learn where things stand for local governments and their employees. Then the Museum of Wisconsin Art recognizes the importance of a Kansas native, early 20th century painter John Stuart Curry.
The role he played in reaching out from the university to artists around the state, his role in the rural art program cannot be underestimated.
Plus, a weekend of laughs is underway in Milwaukee.
It was just kind of an experiment to see if we could bring a bunch of fun people together. And I think as a joke, we called it the first annual Milwaukee Comedy Festival, and people loved it. So we're like, okay, we got to do this again.
And we hear the next audio postcard from the Listening to Mitchell Public Art Project. Lake Effect is next, after this news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's nice to have you listening today. Wisconsin's primary elections are next Tuesday, but it will be the general election in November that many believe will effectively be a referendum, another one on the course Scott Walker has set as governor of Wisconsin. In particular, it will give people in Wisconsin an opportunity to weigh in on one of the governor's signature pieces of legislation, Act 10, which was passed amid a firestorm of controversy months after Walker took office. It greatly scaled back collective bargaining rights for many public employees in the state and required them to pay increased costs for health coverage and pension benefits. At the same time, those employee concessions were said to give public entities, such as cities, counties, and school districts, greater budget flexibility. Writer Eric Gunn explores the impact of Act 10 after 3 years in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and he's with us to share what he has uncovered. Welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You describe the balancing act that municipalities and entities like school boards and associations that oversee school boards and municipal organizations, the balancing act they had over Act 10. Why were they walking such a tightrope as Act 10 was pending?
Well, I think that as frustrated as those entities were with what they saw as an imbalance in the collective bargaining relationship, it also reached a kind of, in many cases, a modus vivendi, a way of living with the situation as it was. And I talked to people, you know, in municipal organizations and in the school board association. Yeah, they wanted changes. They did not really expect the whole edifice of collective bargaining to just be wiped away. In the case of municipalities, to some extent in the case of school boards, in the case of municipalities, especially larger ones, often controlled, even though they're nonpartisan, by people who are basically affiliated with the Democrats, which tend to be pro-union, or so that there were elected by coalitions that included elements of labor. So they were not going to try to delegitimize organized labor as an institution, even if they wanted to gain maybe a little bit more clout at the bargaining table over specific issues.
Is it oversimplifying things to say they were really hoping to have maybe more of an upper hand in bargaining, but they weren't necessarily looking for entirely disgruntled labor force?
Exactly. I think that puts it very precisely.
How do they view it now? I mean, this is essentially the crux of your article, but these organizations, you talk with the organization that kind of organizes school boards, for example. What do they look at Act 10 as now?
Well, I think in some respects, I think they're still walking a certain fine line. But ultimately, okay, it's here. This is what it is. We'll just deal with what is and move forward. And in some cases, there's no sort of single party line about how to deal with it other than obeying the law from the statewide organization. They're ultimately a service organization to the individual school boards. And so how that gets played out will make a difference from one school board to another.
Right. You write that there's a big difference because with some school boards that had very fairly small workforces, there's almost no change.
Correct. Or especially with municipalities and even with school districts where it was relatively small and relations were relatively peaceful. Depending on the sort of the larger politics of the community, things could go on more or less as usual. The employee handbook might turn out to be awfully similar to the contract that had been before. But it, again, is very much going to be a different situation in every community.
You also write about the tension that was created in some places by virtue of this sort of two-tiered public employee workplace that was created.
Right. As I think pretty much everybody knows, the Act 10 legislation kind of carved out specifically firefighters and police officers as an exception who would retain much more of their bargaining rights than all the rest of public employees. As an aside, the one other group is transit workers because of the relationship that transit systems have to federal funds. I didn't even get into that in the story. But as the mayor of Greenfield, Mike Nitzke, said to me, you know, we had this sort of two groups. And in fact, by sheer numbers, the firefighters and police department are the larger chunk of the city's employees. So they're under one set of rules, which is still more expansive than all the rest of the city employees. So that would inevitably create a certain kind of tension. If you think about any time you take two groups of people who once functioned in the same, and then suddenly one group you make special in some way, and one group you're making less special in some way, you're going to have that kind of friction.
So you wrote about municipal governments, but you spent a lot of time in this article writing about the impact that Act 10 has had on school districts, including using the district that the governor's children attended, Wauwatosa, as an example. How do administrators there view what Act 10 has done to that district?
Well, the superintendent said, you know, that it's had a sweeping impact on everything in education. They have tried in various ways to move through, but they acknowledge it's been a challenge. As one principal said, in some ways, it's been more adversarial, not intentionally, but because anytime the administration might want to make a change, there's an immediate pushback. Well, you're only doing this because you can, because you don't have to negotiate it, and you're trying to show your power. So
right, there's a certain stifling of dissent that this generated.
Or perception of stifling of dissent. Certainly, teachers that I talked to said, we don't know. If we want to challenge an idea, does that become insubordination? Back when everybody knew where they stood and there was some union protection, people said they felt a little bit more comfort in advancing questions, in objecting to ideas that they thought simply were wrong.
Right. And you sort of say, I think, in this article that changes in some ways are more in terms of feeling. They aren't necessarily tangible, but it's maybe because nobody has pushed the envelope just yet.
Well, that's certainly true. And what was perhaps not appreciated prior to the enactment of Act 10 is the subtleties and complexities of the union management relationship in schools. Again, that might be something that would be very different from one community to another. But the role that the union played as we saw it tend to be, you know, amplified around contracts.
As an adversarial thing.
An adversarial thing. Whereas there were in various communities, and not just in schools too, you know, efforts at union and management working together. And there was that sort of vehicle to communicate between those two separate interests. And that vehicle basically had all of its wheels stripped off.
Sticking with Wauwatosa for just a moment, the governor and other advocates of Act 10 pointed to the increased flexibility school districts now have in terms of lots of cost savings, the greater health care costs they can pass on to employees, and pension costs that go on to employees. Has that flexibility proven to be sustainable in the time since?
I think it's a little bit hard to see how sustainable it will be until one has a fairly longer time horizon. A big chunk of those were, as one school board official put it to me, really pretty much a one-shot thing. Now, some of those one-shot things accumulate over time. I mean, you're paying less in healthcare this year and next year, if you're the school district, say. But you can't get quite the same big bang for the buck, so to speak, in the future. There are other kinds of costs that nobody has quantified in terms of the hours and money spent in paying a lawyer to, if you're a school district again, deal with your contract issues and help you work out your strategies for the next bargaining and that sort of thing. On the other hand, there are other very subtle costs, such as we're alluding to before, in terms of morale, in terms of the willingness of people to actually step up and say, here are some ideas, here are some ways to do things differently that are very difficult to quantify and are way beyond the scope of what I could do.
You spoke with a teacher at Wauwatosa East, whom the governor had used as kind of the poster child for why he believed Act 10 was necessary. She had initially lost her job at MPS because of a lack of seniority, despite being honored as the top new teacher. How does she look at how the 3+ years since Act 10 have affected her career?
Well, Megan Sampson is a very interesting story because she was really kind of the poster child for the reasons that he felt Act 10 was justified. She was very ambivalent, I think, to say the least, about that. In talking about this, she has always been very, very careful. She does not view herself as a political person.
Right. She never sought this public
persona. She certainly never sought that attention and did not like it when it fell upon her. And she has stayed in teaching. She remains dedicated to teaching. Ironically, as this story reveals, she was this teacher in one of Governor Walker's son's classes a few years later. But she does feel that Act 10 has shown teachers to lack some of the autonomy, authority, power, if you will, in controlling their own destinies as educators. And she's very happy where she is, and I think that needs to be made very clear. But as she thinks about the long term, she thinks, well, maybe there are other avenues within this profession that would allow for more control to really make a difference, in her view, than teaching for the very long term.
Are there any signs of the fracturing that took place over this legislation coming back together, the people on the two sides of the divide?
Yes and no. I mean, there are certainly pockets where there's such a meshing of interests that in many ways, to the extent that's possible, a union management relationship continues in one form or another. But there are other places where this just exposes a greater degree of ongoing polarization. Possibly one of the most dramatic examples of that is in Kenosha. I saw there where the membership on the board sort of seesawed between a one-vote majority that was more sympathetic to union interests and rights and that sort of thing, and a one-vote majority that was clearly antithetical to those. And when the pro-union majority last fall decided there was a window to negotiate a new contract with the union, they did so. They did so with such speed that people who supported Act 10 in a big sort of way were basically able to leverage that into a winning campaign to flip the school board's majority.
This is not unlike the speed with which Act 10 was passed and resulted in so many recall elections that it temporarily flipped the Senate.
That's actually a very good analogy, yes.
Well, it seems like the verdict is still out in a lot of ways. And Eric Gunn, we will perhaps talk with you down the road about this very same thing.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it.
Eric Gunn is a contributing editor at Milwaukee Magazine. His article on the impact of Wisconsin's Act 10 is in the current issue. You'll find a link from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. Next on the program, the Museum of Wisconsin Art hosts a retrospective on the work of Wisconsin painter John Stewart Curry. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. While the Museum of Wisconsin Art often features the work of contemporary artists, it also looks back at the state's art history. And while John Stuart Curry was not born here, he was originally from Kansas, his work left an indelible mark on Wisconsin. Curry's time at UW-Madison in the 30s and 40s represented the first time an American university employed an artist in residence. But he didn't just stay within the walls of academia. He went out into the state to depict rural life as well. And he taught people, too. Museum of Wisconsin Art Director of Collections Graham Reed joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio and explained why it was important for the museum to showcase Curry's work.
It's a question that often comes up with us is what qualifies somebody to be a Wisconsin artist. Now, obviously, Curry wasn't born in Wisconsin. He was born in Dunavant, or just outside Dunavant, Kansas, in 1897. But he spent the last 10 years, 10 very, very important years of his career at Madison as artist in residence. So by dint of that 10 years he spent here, we embrace him as a Wisconsin artist because it really was a very important 10 years for him and how he ties into the state, not only in terms of the university, but what the university was doing, but also the role he played in reaching out from the university to artists around the state, particularly kind of what you might call the non-professional, rural, amateur artists. His role in the rural art program cannot be underestimated.
What was Madison doing? Why was this the first artist in residence in the country? What were they doing differently than any other institution?
Well, I think one of the things you have to remember is back in the early years of the 20th century, there wasn't the huge two-year, four-year network of schools in the UW system that we know today. Basically, Madison was essentially it. I mean, it was the main university in the state. And they were embracing something that's come to be known as the Wisconsin idea. And that's a huge subject in and of itself, but I always kind of shrink the Wisconsin idea down to a couple of things. One, the perception was that the boundaries of campus were the boundaries of the state. You know, you have the ivory tower in Madison and you have the farm silo out in the country. And the Wisconsin idea really endeavored to kind of shrink the gap between the ivory tower and the farm silo, to kind of say from the ivory tower to say to the farmer, we can make your lives better, we can improve your yields, your crops, we can basically make your job better and more successful and more productive. And the Wisconsin idea, I think, also kind of went the other way. It also went for the farmer's point of view, rather than the ivory tower being something that was completely out of touch and irrelevant to their lives. It was, this university actually has something to offer me, and which they did through a thing called the short course, which was basically a class they had every winter for farmers who would come to Madison. So Curry was very much part of this Wisconsin idea thing. And the idea of an artist in residence was new, but Robert Frost had actually been poet in residence at Michigan, and he'd also been poet in residence at Amherst. So the concept of having somebody in one branch of the arts attached to the university was not new, but Curry was certainly the first artist in residence.
And how did that fit into the Wisconsin idea? The idea of having a painter.
Chris Christensen, who was the dean of the College of Agriculture, he truly believed that if you're going to educate a farmer, then it should be a well-rounded education. So it wasn't just, here's how you fix some farm machinery, here's how you plow your field, here's how you plant your crops, here's how you feed your cattle, you know, here's what not to feed them. They felt that, you know, a farmer had as much right to be culturally literate, if you want to put it that way, as the next person.
So the liberal education idea was important all the way
around. Yeah, they basically felt that a well-rounded liberal education was as appropriate for farmers as it was for somebody living in Madison or Milwaukee.
So how did Curry get involved with Madison in the first place? I mean, was he brought in specifically to be the artist in residence and then stayed?
Very much so, okay. Very much so. He was actually living in Westport, Connecticut at the time and had been since the early mid-20s. And he had done quite a number of pieces that focused on Kansas subjects while he was living in Connecticut. But I think he was, like his kind of colleague Benton, who'd also spent some time on the East Coast, he was just dying to get back to the Midwest. Curry was just not terribly comfortable, I think, on the East Coast. His friend Grant Wood had a little bit of a say in kind of pushing Curry's name forward at Madison. But again, one of the things you have to remember is Curry was ranked among the top five artists in the country at the time. So I think what's remarkable is that you know, for an experimental program, which this was, Curry came in through the College of Agriculture. He did not come in through the art department. That the university didn't kind of play it safe and say, well, you know, this is experimental. Let's try. We'll just bring in a local in-state artist. We'll see how it works out. They went right for the top. I mean, they went to get one of the most high-profile, successful artists in the country and bring him in. And one of the really neat things we have in the exhibition that I found in a file in Madison is we have the original telegram from Chris Christensen offering Curry the position. And the very next day, Curry replied by telegram, and we have that in the exhibition as well. Curry replies accepting the position. So he didn't have to – he didn't think about it terribly hard. I mean, this wasn't a –
a difficult decision.
This was not a difficult decision. It was a very sweet deal. I mean, he basically was getting paid $4,000 a year, which was not an inconsiderable sum of money in 1936. He essentially had no teaching responsibilities. And they were going to build him a studio, which ultimately the state paid for. But he was really charged with doing his own work, engaging with campus, but also playing that very critical role in reaching out to the artists around the state, whether it was through judging, the rural art program, going to 4-H fairs. I mean, he very much traveled around the state and engaged with the rural artists. And there was a wonderful, I don't think it's an apocryphal story. I do believe it's a true story. But there was a wonderful story I found in the file about a miner from El Dorado, Illinois, called Vashel Davis, who, you know, spent his days and weeks and months and years hacking away at the coal face, but he loved to draw. And he apparently sent a couple of drawings and a letter off to, you know, the famous John Stuart Curry in Madison and expected to hear nothing. And he gets a letter in the mail from John Stuart Curry kind of basically saying, yeah, this isn't too bad. Why don't you come up sometime and I'll show you a few tricks? And the newspaper article said that Vashel Davis promptly fainted upon receiving the letter. But off he goes. He goes up. He obviously takes some vacation time and goes up to Madison. And you know, here's this miner from El Dorado, Illinois, sitting in the same studio as John Stuart Curry, who had at this point had painted, you know, murals at the Treasury Department in Washington, D.C. Was one of the top artists in the state. Had major shows, major exhibitions. And I think Vashel Davis was having to kind of pinch himself that, you know, here he was in this famous artist studio, and Curry would kind of come over and, you know, have a little look at what he was up to and make a suggestion or take his brush in his hand and, you know, make a couple of brush strokes. But I think that kind of in some ways exemplifies what Curry did with the rural art program. And fundamentally, I think he had the right personality for it. One of the kind of defining experiences I think that I always think of with Curry's career was after he left the farm in Donovan, Kansas, he actually enrolled at the Kansas City Art Institute. And basically, nobody ever remembers him ever actually being there. And I think it was because Curry, here he was a farm boy from Kansas, and he goes to the Kansas City Art Institute. And I think people kind of looked down their nose and thought, who's this farm boy? You know, I mean, who's this hick from the sticks? And I think that had a tremendous influence on how he kind of behaved and acted when he became the artist in residence at Madison, because he had been treated as that outsider. People had looked down their nose and said, well, you're not a professional artist. I'm not going to waste my time with you. And I think that gave Curry a huge empathy for these miners, milkmen, electricians, housewives. I mean, the range of occupations is almost endless of the people that he worked with the rural art program at Madison.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the actual exhibition itself. Where did you draw the artworks from? You obviously couldn't get his entire oeuvre.
The Chazen Museum in Madison was enormously. We couldn't have done the show without the Chazen, Russell Pachenko and the Chazen staff in Madison. I mean, they lent The Good Earth, which is really one of his most iconic paintings from 1942, which is the farmer standing in the wheat field clutching the three strands of grain. We've got the three paintings that he did in 1941 for First National Bank in Madison. We've got five fantastic football-related works. The 1941 yearbook, we have a copy of that, and that was actually dedicated to Curry. He did five illustrations for it, four of which are still in existence, and we have those four in the show. And again, it may be many, many decades since those have ever been exhibited together. The thing with Curry is, he often got criticized, actually, even from fellow artists like Grant Wood, Reginald Marsh, Thomas Hart Benton. Curry frustrated them a little bit, I think, because I think they felt like, John, you're a better artist than your paintings show. And I think they just got a little frustrated. And you can certainly see this in the last, and we have the last painting he ever did in 1946 is in the exhibition. And it's a mural that was done for State Fair Park. And it shows, some farmers, and they're all heading, kind of walking across the plain of the picture towards the smoking ruins of Europe, which, was after the Second World War, obviously. And, it is not the greatest painting in the world, technically. It's about a certain time, it's about a certain place, it's about what certain groups of people were doing in Wisconsin with regard to the aftermath of the war and rebuilding Germany. And also Curry was very, very sick as he was doing this. But one of the things I put in the show is I put in some drawings. There's a couple of this exquisite chalk drawings for the football things. But one of the other things I'm really happy to have in the show is in 1941, and this kind of all circles back to the Wisconsin idea and what the university was doing to improve the lives of ordinary Wisconsinites, is he did in 1941, he was commissioned to do some murals for the biochemistry building, which had been one of the most innovative departments on campus in the early years of the 20th century. So he's commissioned to do these murals in 1941, which are still in the biochemistry building, and they've been restored in recent years. But we have the original drawings for the center panel. But one of the reasons why I put the drawings in is I wanted to show that for all the kind of criticism Curry sometimes got in terms of his technique, is he was a very sound draftsman, very sound. I mean, he had the chops when it came to drawing. He had the chops. And so we put those into the show, one, because I wanted to show that Curry really had the talent to draw, but I also wanted to show, and I think people often enjoy this, is they really like to kind of see preparatory work. It's like, oh, here's the sketch, here's the finished painting. How similar are they? And just see how an artist, kind of the process an artist goes through in arriving at a final drawing that, murals, he doesn't just start straight on the wall. There's a lot of preparatory work to do it. So, that's just one of the great things we've got in the exhibition, is many things in the show have never been seen in public before.
What do we take away from John Stuart Curry's legacy now? What do we take away from looking at his work and thinking about his place in the state's history?
You take away a couple of things. One, the Wisconsin idea is very much still alive, but it's now so kind of integrated into different parts of the state and different departments that I think we take a lot of it for granted. But I think one of the things that I take away is, as much as things have changed, and this is very true. There was a young couple at the opening, and they were talking to one of my colleagues, and they said, we really love this show. We don't have to think about it. We don't have to try and decipher it. We don't have to try and struggle with understanding it. And it's amazing, if you come in and see the show, even though these works were done in the 30s and 40s, Wisconsin still looks very similar to certain scenes in this painting. We still have a Badger football team in the state. We still have people going to college. We still have farmers. We still have the university coming up with all kinds of inventions and experiments through the departments that make people's lives better. So this is just a particular snapshot from 1936 to 1946, but I think it shows that Curry was very much part of the Wisconsin idea, and that Wisconsin idea is alive and well, and the state, in many cases, still looks very similar. So it's kind of nice to see, as much as things have changed and improved, some things have just stayed the same.
Well, Graham Reed, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Bonnie.
Graham Reed is Director of Collections at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. The exhibition, John Stuart Curry at Home in Wisconsin, is open through September 14th. There is a link to more information and pictures at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. An extended weekend of comedy is already underway in Milwaukee. We'll get the inside story on the Milwaukee Comedy Festival next. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. It is going to be a funny weekend in Milwaukee. Actually, it's already a funny time because the 9th Annual Milwaukee Comedy Festival is already underway. The festival features 4 days of live performances, including stand-up, improv, sketch, and musical comedy acts. It bills itself as the largest comedy event in Wisconsin, and it brings in acts from around the nation and a lot of local talent as well. It kicked off yesterday. It runs through Sunday at Next Act Theater. Milwaukee Comedy Festival founder and producer Matt Kemple and co-producer Patrick Schmitz visited recently with WUWM's Rachel Owens. Kemple talked about how the festival has evolved since its founding 9 years ago.
It was just kind of an experiment to see if we could bring a bunch of fun people together. And I think as a joke, we called it the first annual Milwaukee Comedy Festival, and people loved it. So we're like, okay, we got to do this again.
Yeah.
Great. And this is its 9th year, right?
Yeah, cool. 9 years.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that most people, if you say comedy, I work in comedy, most people would think of stand-up. Is that right? Or
a lot. Yeah, most people do. Some people think of Saturday Night Live or something like that, but it's generally a stand-up production. So that's one thing that's really important to us is we just love all styles of comedy. And Patrick and I both have a pretty heavy improv background. So being able to include different styles of comedy for people to offer a real variety is exciting for us because audiences are exposed to new things and they end up finding something they like they didn't know they liked or discovering something new they didn't know existed.
And you're going to be having musical comedy, like you said, improv, sketch. For people who haven't seen those other forms, could you give us just a little taste of what those are like?
Sure. I think they taste like apples, if I remember correct. Well, sketch comedy can be most compared to something like Saturday Night Live or Mad TV, where it's skits or sketches that are shorter and put together sometimes with a common theme or something like that. Improv means it's all done right then and there. It's all made up on the spot. They don't write those scenes down ahead of time. That would be sketch. And then stand-up, of course, is normally a single person with a microphone telling jokes.
And something unique with the improv, especially is long form, isn't seen a lot in Milwaukee. It's definitely getting bigger, but you know, we have comedy sports, which is short form, but we have a lot of long form groups that come in, and long form meaning they just get a word from the audience and they go. You know, they just improvise a whole story, or they'll do a number of improvised scenes or whatever it is. But
40 minutes, and you know, somebody gets a word like toaster, and then you develop an entire scene. You know, hopefully not just about a toaster. Hopefully it's about the people around that toaster and the relationship between them. But it can be really fun to see something that's never happened before, you know, and we cram all that into 9 shows this year.
Something like that.
It's hard to remember.
Yeah.
And yeah, for people who haven't seen improv, I've done a little bit of that myself, just taking classes, and it's incredibly difficult. Like, people might expect just a game, but people who are really good at it, they're really developing, like you said, a mini movie right in front of you.
Mm-hmm. I like to think of improv especially, but comedy as a genre is really a muscle that needs to be exercised. So the more that you exercise that muscle, the better you get. So, you know, you put a show on, you want to make sure you exercise that muscle a lot. The same way that a marathon runner wouldn't just start running, you need to kind of build up to that. And you learn skills along the way, and it gets a little easier.
A lot of people are surprised to find out that there are rules to improv. And sometimes it can fall into a more formulaic style, unfortunately. But, you know, the challenge is to not do that and to try to always make it true improv. But, you know, you kind of fall into characters that maybe you've done before, you know, situation of the roommate moving out, you know, the scene about the divorce, you know, so you see a lot of that. But then how do you make that different in your own style, which is a nice thing to see people take on that and put it in a different light. And yeah, I mean, improv is theater. Ideally, it's like you said, we're putting together a mini movie or a play and they're building a story and there's a plot and a through line and fully developed characters. And that's the challenge of long-form improv, is to make that work and then to be funny on top of that.
Hopefully.
We're
very fortunate because, like Patrick mentioned earlier, the long-form scene in Milwaukee is getting a lot stronger. We have some really fantastic performers in town, but we're also bringing people in that are real true experts in the form from all over the country. So for all of us to come together and, you know, play around a little bit on stage and see some really great things that nobody has ever seen before, it's
it's just exciting.
Yeah, I'm curious about the comedy scene in Milwaukee in general, especially I would think a lot of people might feel it's kind of in the shadow of a major city like Chicago. How do you see the Milwaukee and the Wisconsin comedy scene?
I think it's grown so much over the years, and I think the Comedy Fest has a little bit to do with that, but also there's just a lot more opportunities now than there was 10 years ago, and there's a lot of ways that people can find each other. You know, it's a lot easier to jump on Facebook and find some people you might be able to do some comedy with as opposed to 10 years ago where, I don't know, maybe you'd send postcards to people or something. But it's exciting to see. It used to really be an underground scene and nobody really knew about it. You'd like to have to know somebody to know about the shows. And now it's really great. There's stuff happening every week in town that's comedy related and various improv and sketch shows and stand-up, and so it's really cool.
So about, what would you say, maybe about half of the performers are coming from out of town or out of state?
I think that's about right.
Yeah, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
Or last year, definitely more. And this year we brought it a little bit more Milwaukee heavy. But that's because a few groups have popped up that are really good recently.
Yeah.
So
it's exciting for us to kind of reflect on previous years and see, like, there's some groups like Broad Minded, an all-women's sketch comedy group in town. They've been a part of every single Comedy Fest, and their very first show was the very first Comedy Fest. So It's kind of cool to watch them grow over the years. But then also you see different groups form and different groups break apart and form other groups. It's sort of like bands break up and form super groups or things like that. So this year we were really excited because there's just such a strong presence of great comedic talent in town. Made our job a little easier.
I've realized that with a lot of comedy that many times people are so in the moment that what they're doing for them, they get so enveloped in their role that seems like they're not trying to be funny, but what they're doing by contrast is so funny because they're so sincere about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I teach improv and I have been teaching it at First Stage for quite a while, almost 12 years now. And I always ask my students, you know, for improv, what are we essentially doing up here? And they'll always say, well, we try to make the audience laugh. I said, well, okay, let's put that to the side. Yes, humor is a big part of improv comedy. But I have to tell them and remind them constantly, we're here to make connections with people on stage. Like Matt said, the scene's not about the toaster. It's about the people and what's going on in this story and the reactions and the honest and organic situations and the organic reactions to the actions and so on and so forth. The best way to put it, and one of the teachers at Second City said this, improv, it's not people doing funny things. It's funny people doing things.
Yeah.
So the people, I mean, we as human beings are already funny. If you just go up and act honestly and you're true to your character, there's going to be some humor there because the audience can be able to relate to that and go, oh my gosh, I've been there. And oh, I wish I could have said that to my boss, or I wish I could have done that, and so on and so forth.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's actually funnier to be more realistic. If there's a scene and somebody comes in and says, oh, hey, the barn's on fire. You know, okay, great, thanks, I'll see you later. You know, there's nothing really exciting that comes out of that. But if somebody comes screaming onto the stage, acting as if there really is a barn on fire and we got to do something, that can create some amazing, funny moments. So to try to be funny in a scene like that can actually be the reverse, and you end up being up there and nobody's laughing. But to be true to that situation, and like Patrick said, you have a funny person in a crazy situation, there's going to be some comedy that comes out of it. So that you act truthfully, like, what would you really do if the barn was on fire? Okay, great, let's do that and let's see what happens on stage.
What is the mission beyond just getting people in to see some good comedy?
I mean, for us, I think it really comes down to wanting to connect with other people and connecting other comedians with other comedians and bringing people in from out of town and seeing, you know, hey, how does somebody do this in Boston? How does somebody do this in South Carolina? How does that differ from the style that Milwaukee is creating? So for us, I think it's really important to foster the comedy community and to create an environment that's just a lot more positive. The whole reason that I do comedy, some people get political, some people get really religious, some people give money to the poor. I can't do those things, but I can
bring joy to people's lives, then to me, that's what makes it all worth it. So I feel like that's really the underlying mission of what we do, is to really try to spread joy in a positive way, and to do it in a fun way. You know, there's a way to put a festival on that can be a money-hungry promotion, and then there's a way to put a festival on that the way that we do it is we're really trying to connect with the performers. We're trying to have the audience and the performers have as much fun together as possible. It's not just somebody's up on stage doing a job and they don't care if they do their job well or not. It's all about the audience having the best experience possible and the performers being up there and wanting to be there.
All of these performances are happening at Next Act Theater?
Mm-hmm. Yep, right in Walker's Point. It's a beautiful venue, and for me personally, I think it's one of the best venues in town. It's just so intimate, but you can fit a nice number of people in there, and I mean, you can whisper on stage and everybody can hear it. It's great. So for comedy, being able to feel that energy from the audience is really important. So in a venue like that, it's great.
Is there going to be a lot of opportunities for audience participation?
Not really. There will be plenty of opportunities for the audience to be able to interact with the comedians in the lobby and be able to talk to people about comedy. There might occasionally be somebody that's pulled up on stage for their will, not anybody pulled up against their will. We don't want to make anybody uncomfortable.
Which is one of our
it's a common question.
Popular answer as to why people won't go to a comedy show. They're afraid of getting, I don't want to get called up on stage. I don't want the audience, or I don't want them coming out to me and sitting on my lap and doing any. So we understand that some people, they don't like that. As funny as it might be for the audience to see this person be extremely uncomfortable, this is what some people are dreading, and then concludes to them not wanting to ever come to a show. So we're very conscious of, and Comedy Sports also does a really good job of that, of never forcing anyone up on stage at their own will.
It needs to be fun for everybody, not fun for everybody but that guy that's getting picked on.
And what about if people are really inspired by this festival, they see a show and then they want to get involved with comedy here in Milwaukee, what would you recommend for people?
Well, I can plug my website if that's okay.
Sure.
So MilwaukeeComedy.com has information on not just the shows that I produce, but shows all over town. So there's a news tab on there. You can click on the news tab and see information about all sorts of really awesome comedy shows. And then there's also a Learn Comedy tab and things like that, so comedians can figure out how to connect with other comedians. There's helpful advice as far as like starting out, checking out open mics, things like that.
Is there one thing that you guys really enjoy more than anything else?
I'll be honest. I'm at a point now where I love producing and putting up shows, because getting a compliment like, hey, you were really funny up there, obviously that's a great compliment to get. But when you get a compliment like, thank you so much for putting this together, this is like the best day of the year for something like Sketch 22 I do twice a year, they'll say this is always my favorite day of the year. And to get a compliment like that where it's like, wow, I was responsible for somebody's, you know, participation and happiness in that way. And I think that's a big reason Matt and I like working together, because we make those opportunities, whether it's teaching workshops, supplying a place for it, putting together an event like the festival.
There is sort of this like magic moment as a producer where all the work is done and you're sort of exhausted, but you're having a great time and you're standing there and you see all those performers up there are having a great time. The audience is in stitches from laughing so much, and you're like, oh, this is why I do this.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
There's worse ways to spend your day, I think. So,
right.
Yeah, I would totally agree. For me, I really love working with other people. I love putting the puzzle pieces together and seeing it all kind of end up being something people want to be a part of.
Well, Matt and Patrick, thank you so much for coming in to talk about the Milwaukee Comedy Festival, the 9th annual, and wish you lots of great luck going into it this year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt Kempel is founder and producer of the Milwaukee Comedy Festival. Patrick Schmitz is co-producer. They spoke with WUWM's Rachel Owens. The festival runs through Sunday. You'll find a link to the schedule at WUWM.com/Lake Effect. One last break, and then a Lake Effect essayist and pretty funny guy himself weighs in on the latest impromptu debate over the importance of art in our culture. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Recently, the hosts of a Milwaukee morning radio show, not this one, raised a minor furor with their remarks about the importance of art, or the lack thereof. Naturally, Lake Effect essayist Jonathan West has an opinion.
Here's the thing. A lot of people don't like to go to opera. It's true. It's sad. Opera is great. So is ballet. So is theater. So is dance. But so are cheeseburgers. And if I were a betting man, I would lay large money that cheeseburgers would win a popularity contest over any of those art forms, even though artsy things surely make you look better in a swimsuit. Every once in a while, the arts community sits up aware that a sharp stick is being poked into its intelligent eye. It's an ouchy, hurty kind of thing that makes artists spread some bruised and ruffled feathers and caw at or peck out the eye of the offender. Recently, our fair city's arts community started to sense that a ruthless poke was being inflicted by three on-air drive-time morning radio squawkers who daily play as much unplugged Eric Clapton as a soul can bear. This feckless gang are all as suburban, pale, and middle-aged as most of the folks filling our local arts venues. They sounded contrary. It was suggested that opera was boring, and a city might be better off without a thriving arts community. It should also be noted that these are the same three radio professionals whose daily Hollywood trash segment makes them all giggle like teenage girls. Locally, we dealt with this rather public commentary on how the arts maybe aren't everyone's cup of tea with a kind of, oh yeah, and so are you kind of attitude. Then, right on the heels of righteous indignation, a mini-national crisis struck scores of Sauvignon Blanc sippers when Ira Glass, the venerable nebbish sex symbol host of This American Life, tweeted that he thought Shakespeare, Bill the Bard himself, might just suck a little. Depending on the company you keep, you may have heard this said in stronger terms. Opinions are like belly buttons. Everyone has them. And like those belly buttons we all have, opinions come in all shapes and sizes. Many in our local arts community were ready to burn the offending radio host in effigy, stunned by the slight. And then, the poster boy of National Public Radio, the radio station of note for people who actually buy chamber music subscriptions, started chipping away at the notion that Shakespeare isn't as fresh as the hottest new farm-to-table restaurant. This almost seemed too much for all of us to bear. But there's an essential question to ask ourselves. If a morning drive-time radio show team jabbers about snoozing through an opera or ballet performance, and Ira Glass reveals that Shakespeare isn't about to move him an inch, why in the world should we really care? Not everyone likes everything about art, and that's painfully hard to take for we who make the art. The people who talk openly and freely about how the arts don't move them aren't the enemy, as much as we might want to claim they are. Enemy forces are revealed in the fact that some of what we in the arts do can still be referenced in an antique store. The real heroes of the arts, those who go into work every day and believe that everyone should be a supporter, aren't wrong. I just think they might sometimes be too close to the point to see it. We'll always need to think about new ways to captivate our audiences. That's something that causes us to be out of our comfort zone and think in new creative ways. Innovation is messy and hard. Those of us in the arts are often accustomed to being uncomfortable because of a lack of money, resources, and too much competition. And it hurts a little more to hear that people are bored with our life's work. That all sucks, of course, and it's just plain human nature to want to be loved. But I've been plenty bored by lots of plays in my life, even ones I've directed or acted in, ready to chew my arm off at an opera or dance concert or two, and wanted to stick pins in my eyes at several concerts I've seen. Yet, and I don't think I'm alone in having those experiences and feeling the way I do, I love all the arts, fine, unrefined, and raw as they may be. Let us not overlook the fact that Ira Glass tweeted about not liking Shakespeare while actually seeing a play. And one of the local radio show hosts said on air, I like going to shows, plays, concerts. It depends. What more can we ask of anyone? It does depend. It always should. And in so many ways, that's what makes art matter.
Jonathan West is a writer and theater artist based in Milwaukee. Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr are Milwaukee-based artists who work together to create site-specific public art projects. Their most recent is named Listening to Mitchell, and they're sharing audio postcards from the project here on Fridays until the end of September. Here is this week's piece.
Listening to Mitchell is an installation of image and sound that transforms over 50 interviews into an experience of place and its collective memory. The installation is currently on the street, woven through historic Mitchell Street's 7 blocks from the Majeska to St. Stan's. And throughout its duration, we are sharing the voices and the sounds of Mitchell Street here on Lake Effect.
Nothing matters when we're dancing.
The magical component of the rhythm of people and moving, kind of trying to find how, you know, this passerby can just pause their car or stop if they're walking.
You know, with the skateboards and, rah, rah, and the pipes going and the boom, boom, boom boxes.
Back in the day, they, you know, you have people with those big boom box radios, you know. You were hearing, you know, music from different places of the world.
Mostly polkas and waltzes and shadishes. And once you got in there, all you did was dance. I dance every dance. It's either dance or go home, you know.
On Saturdays, they would have a cardboard outside, and everybody from the South Side would come and break dance there, and they would battle the breakers, the lady breakers, Dirty Mind, like they would all come.
I'm a dancer, and when you're a dancer, you're supposed to turn into things.
And they had a dance hall on the top floor, so we used to go up there and...
When you dance, it should be a reflection of who you are. The people who watch you dance, the people around you, other dancers... They want to see that passion in you, or you're not a successful Aztec dancer.
When we were growing up, we didn't have a lot of stuff that you bought. We always had what we needed. We never went hungry. We would dance at home, you know, like my grandmother would come over, and if my mom and dad went out for an evening, which was rare, but if they did, we'd be dancing. Your dad and I would jitterbug and...
I can come straight from work and forget everything and just kind of dance and do steps that our ancestors, in a way, were doing. And I think that's very...
On Mitchell Street.
I think that's very empowering.
Listening to Mitchell is a public art project by Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr. Listening to Mitchell's 18-channel immersive audio installation is closing this weekend. It will be open today from 3 to 6:30 and Sunday from 2 to 5:30. The audio installation is located at 723 West Mitchell. To learn more about Listening to Mitchell events and happenings, you'll find a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You'll hear another radio installment in the series next Friday. That is all the time we have for today. We are produced by Bonnie North and Dan Harmon, with web assistance from Michelle Maternowski, studio engineering from John Strelecki, and production assistance from the team of Brooke Dowden, Eleanor Peterson, and Audrey Nowakowski. I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening once again, and I sure hope you can join us tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend, and be back here again on Monday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR. Are in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Coming your way at 12 noon. It's Here and Now, but right now it's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.